My name's Kester Bruin. I'm part of the Talks team for Greenbelt, and it's a huge privilege to welcome Alistair McIntosh back to Greenbelt. What better precursor to a talk on the subject that he's going to be speaking on than having a large machine kind of rattling away in front of us this morning. But well done to those guys. I met Alistair for a week on the tiny island of Iona a couple of years ago, and was very much blessed by what he had to say there and by some of our late night discussions at the local pub. Alistair is a unique figure in his experience of environmental issues. He is a visiting professor of human ecology at the University of Strathclyde. He has written so much on these issues, but is also an incredibly practical and personally involved man in these things as well, working as he does in Glasgow city centre with young people, reconnecting them with the ancient crafts and with the environment around them. So without further ado, I'm sure we'll be very, very happy to give him a huge warm welcome to Alistair McIntosh. Thank you.
Well, thank you, and a warm good morning to you. Not that it's that warm at this time of day, but it'll warm up inside us, hopefully. One day the Pharisees and the Sadducees came to test Jesus' claim by asking him to show them a miraculous sign from heaven. He replied, "You know the saying, red sky at night means fair weather tomorrow. Red sky in the morning means foul weather all day. You are good at reading the weather signs in the sky, but you can't read the obvious signs of the times." And what I would like to do in these three talks that I'm going to be giving today, tomorrow, and Monday is explore some of the signs of our times. Today I'm going to talk about the violence of our times. And some of what I'm going to say might be quite challenging to some of you. I'm going to try and put it as best I can, because I think we need to look very deeply at the roots of what we understand to be the Christian religion. Tomorrow I'm going to be talking about the climate of our times, about climate change, and how it is, in my view, at root a spiritual problem, much more so than a political, technical, or economic problem. And on Monday at 5 o'clock, I'm going to be talking about the love of our times. I'm going to be trying to pull together what I'm saying today about violence and tomorrow about climate change, and looking at the need, the imperative, to re-establish community, to rebuild relationship between us. I'd like to start by looking at violence, by reading from a letter that arrived through the post last week. I've since contacted the person who sent me this letter, and he has agreed to me using it with some modification, hence I've typed out here an abridged version. Normally, as you know, or those of you who know me will know, I don't speak from notes, but today I've got quite extensive, not notes, but quotations that I'm going to be using. I see they've kindly provided me with pegs to stop things from blowing away today. And here's a letter that came through the post. I read the first two pages with some puzzlement, wondering why this stranger was writing, saying things that seemed to be of relatively light consequence, until I got to the second two pages, when the reason for his warm-up hit. He started off saying things like, "I'm at Greenbelt every year. I regard it as my one annual genuinely profound visit to church. Though I attend regularly one of the more far-flung outposts of," he names the church, but I won't say it here, "it's one of the mainstream British churches that has a mission abroad." He continues, "I feel that there I tiptoe in waters that never get any deeper, and there is no opportunity to swim or dive. And so the talks I hear at Greenbelt and the MP3s I download keep me going. At present I live and work in," and he names a country he prefers that I don't name here in case it makes the work of himself or his organisation difficult. You must have seen it in the news recently. So much blood has been spilled, and the wounds of innocent people are not allowed to start to heal. When the vast war machines were at their prime, the analogy of Moloch, remember Moloch, the stone, hollow gourd filled with fire that the ancient Israelites reputedly sacrificed their children into to ensure prosperity for the future. The analogy of Moloch was inescapable, and it was made most striking by the literal sacrifice of the children. Each family was forced to give up one child to fight, one to the war effort. Children perhaps 12 years old, consumed by this Moloch in order to perpetuate destruction. Can you even begin to imagine being faced with that decision? Which child to send? Which one to give up? The vast machine stretches from the financiers in China and Iran and Russia, and presumably not excluding ourselves here with our armaments industry, all the way to the dry battlefields of this place where he was writing from, where children are forced out in front to face an enemy that isn't theirs. The interiority of it all, note that expression, Walter Wink says that spirituality is the interiority, the inside of outer forms. The interiority of all this violence is an almost tangible destructive force. This year, the soul of it all found new depth, its true bleakness, supported by a population buoyed along by a tide of popular ignorance. Meanwhile, in my own organisation, I face my own battles. Note how this paragraph brings it back to where I'm sure many of us are at with our organisations. My own battles to try to keep some clarity of where value lies, to try to keep pushing, keep up my own fight, while all around the bureaucracy and the mediocrity encroaches, while all around the bureaucracy and the mediocrity encroaches. There, my friends, in a nutshell, in that letter from one of you who may be sitting out there at this moment, is a summary of the violence of our times. There you see somebody, as Walter Wink would put it, naming the powers that be, having the courage to stand up and say what is happening, using metaphorical imagery like Moloch or Mammon to draw out that inner spirituality revealed by the second stage of activism in Wink's schema, which is unmasking the powers that be, having named them, showing how they exert a violence that is psychological and spiritual upon us, as well as physical. And only then, only with that courage, with that strength of heart, being able to start engaging the powers that be, engaging with, wrestling with violence, not just in our outward lives, but where the battle most starts, in our inner lives. You see, what we are talking about is all around. It's in us with what we buy. This mobile phone I've got to tell the time contains coltan won by war in Africa. By holding this phone in my hand, I too am complicit in the violence that makes it possible for me to have this. Mary McCann, a Scottish poet, in her poem Working for Moloch, says, and note the banality of violence, as Hannah Arendt called it in relation to the Nazi violence, the banality of this. She says, the cleaners are scrubbing the institute lavatories because women are supposed to do that. The young men are doing their PhDs because young men are obedient and ambitious. And somebody wants warheads, multi-channel, night-seeking radar, and science is neutral. At the top of the tower, the old men and the middle-aged men, and sometimes one woman professor, meet to form plans, catch funds, and run the place. Because obedient young men turn into obedient old men. And it's all for the good of the country, and science is neutral. And no one notices Moloch. And it's hard to see Moloch because he's both far away and everywhere. And no one asks to whom they are all obedient. And they say, "Who's Moloch? Never heard of him." As out in the dark, Moloch belches and grows redder and redder and fatter as he eats the children. Can you even begin to imagine being faced with that decision? Which child to send and which one to give up? Alice Walker, the black American poet, points to the way in which violence, to use a phrase from Allen Ginsberg, entered my soul early. Moloch entered my soul early. Violence starts as soon as a child is taught to relate not with empathy, but in a manner that is competitive, exploitative. Alice Walker, in her poem called SM, I presume that stands for sadomasochism, says, "I tell you, chickadee, I am afraid of people who cannot cry. Tears left unshed turn to poison in the ducts. Ask the next soldier you see enjoying a massacre if this is not so." People who do not cry are victims of soul mutilation paid for in Marlboros and trucks. Resist! Violence does not work except for the man who pays your salary. Who knows? If you could still weep, you would not take the job. Every year for the past 12 years or so, I've had the strange privilege as a Quaker pacifist of being invited to lecture on the Advanced Command and Staff course to some 300 or 400 senior military at a time, Britain's foremost defence college. And I get given a completely carte blanche. And over the years, I've managed to persuade them. It didn't in a way take a lot of persuading because there's some very thoughtful people, surprisingly, in the military. Very thoughtful people because they have to face the consequences of what happens. I remember sitting at a dinner with two generals and the rather shocked look on my face. This was just after one of them had played a very senior role in launching the attack on Baghdad. And I said, "So how does it feel, gentlemen, possibly to be war criminals?" My hostess looked duly taken aback. And the most senior general said to me, "It is something that I take very seriously." I don't want on the record here with this being taped to say what he said from then. But I do recall a conversation where one very senior man over a bottle of whiskey late at night said, "I hate it." "You hate what?" I asked him. I hate the way we sit in offices in London, programming the bombing coordinates into our computers for the night's attack. And we are not able to see the targets we are hitting. And we are not able to satisfy ourselves personally that we are not hitting civilian targets. I say to them, how can you do it? At the end of the day, one general said to me, I found myself in a position, this was with regard to Iraq, where I had to say to myself, do I accept that I live in a democracy and I have to follow my democratically elected prime minister? Or do I make out that I know better? And I decided I had to accept that I live in a democracy. One of Tony Blair's spin doctors, Lance Price, said in the unexpurgated version of his diaries that a newspaper published, I couldn't help but feeling that Tony Blair was relishing his first blooding as Prime Minister, sending the boys into action in the Christmas 1998 airstrikes against Iraq. Despite all the necessary stuff about taking action with a heavy heart, I think he feels it's part of his coming of age as a leader. And believe me, when you talk with military who have been in a position of having to kill and watching their comrades be killed, in my experience, about three-fifths of them have very profound misgivings about the legitimacy of what this country was doing in Iraq. And it leaves them in a most invidious position. That is the reason why, I think, they are receptive to listening more widely to debate about how we should deal with conflict in the world. General Sir Richard Dannett, who last week stood down as head of the British Army, told Sarah Sands in the Daily Mail in October 13, 2006, and how is this for a political rebuke? Honesty is what it's all about. The truth will out. We've got to speak the truth. Leaking and spinning at the end of the day are not helpful. In the army, we place a lot of store by the values we espouse. Courage, loyalty, integrity, respect for others. These are critical things. I think it's important as an army entrusted with using lethal force that we do maintain high values and that there is a moral dimension to that and a spiritual dimension. Now, as a pacifist, I, of course, would say that that spiritual dimension moves us towards the necessity of repudiating lethal violence. For many in the military, they take very seriously Augustinian just war theory. You know, the idea that Augustine of Hippo came up with, that war must be proportional. It must be waged by legitimate authority. It must not affect non-combatants, etc. The principles upon which things like the Geneva Convention are based. However, my question to you this morning is, did Jesus teach just war? Is that what it's about? I recall speaking to a Church of England bishop at the time that Britain invaded Iraq and asking, why isn't the Archbishop of Canterbury doing more to speak out publicly against the war at this time? He didn't do nothing. But for all that I admire him and he has been generous to me personally, did he do as much as he might have done to have thrown a spanner in Blair's path in terms of the legality, the legitimacy, the spirituality of war? And the bishop replied to me, Alistair, you would not realise when you start moving into this kind of a position the incredible social pressure you are under, a pressure that can construct your very reality. He said, I'm not saying that that is what has happened. In Rowan Williams' case, I can only tell you in my own experience, you would not believe the social pressure you can be under to massage your message in a particular way. And he gave me a personal example that I need not recount here in terms of 10 Downing Street attempting to bring that pressure on his own utterances. Now, my question today is whether the testimony of the churches on violence, not just in the outward wars, but in the roots of wars all the way through our society, our competitive society, where we train our children to set themselves against each other, right the way into our own hearts. My question is whether the voice of the church, the churches, of spiritual groups generally, of all the faiths that are based upon love, whether that voice is bearing true witness. And my view is that it isn't. And the reason why is that the Christian churches generally have failed to come to grips with the dynamics of violence and love that we find in the scriptures. Now, let me be very clear to you. I speak here as a Quaker Universalist who had a Scottish Presbyterian upbringing. I see myself deeply grounded and moving in Christianity. And yet I also consider that other faiths, Islam, Hinduism, some of the neo-pagan approaches and so on, I also consider that they are valid too, if they are predicated upon love. I believe there are many ways up the same mountain, that God, that Christ, if you like, is bigger than any of us can imagine. Remember when St. Thomas Aquinas died in 1273, he said on the morning of his death, this man who wrote the Summa Theologia, you know, a theory of everything for theology, the sum of theology. He said, I see now in my deathbed vision that all that I have written is as nothing compared with the vision before me now. So let us be humble about our own denominations, aware of our own blind spots. That's the basis from which I speak to you. In speaking to you from that universalist position, I do now want to go very specifically into the Judeo-Christian tradition. And I want to put it to you that there are far too many passages in the Old Testament about which few sermons are preached. I find in my discussions with people about these passages that many Christians have a very structured way of reading the Bible, in that there are passages they will read over and over again, and other passages they will be in complete denial of. I myself am not homosexual, but when I hear Christian friends attacking homosexuals, I will say to them, well, okay, so it's going to be law of Moses, is it? Tell me, that fire in your fireplace, on what day did you light it? Because today is the Sabbath day. According to the law of Moses, if you kindle a fire in your house on the Sabbath day, you are subject to the death penalty. Are we going to apply that one as well? And I have actually had very religious people, in the Hebrides even, say to me, that's not in the Bible. And it's just they haven't read that bit, or they have read it and they've skimmed over it. Now, I think we do the same with violence. And the consequence of that is we fail to acknowledge the depth of violence in our traditions. How's my time going? I'm told we can continue till just after 10 because the venue isn't needed until 15:15. So I can be a little bit more relaxed on time than I was going to be. The same day Joshua captured Makkedah, putting it and its king to the sword. He delivered them over to the curse of destruction. This is the Jerusalem Bible translation. With every living creature there, and let no one escape. Joshua and all Israel went with him, went on from Makkedah to Libnah, and attacked it. And Yahweh put this too and its king at Israel's mercy. And Israel put every living creature there to the sword and left none alive. Joshua and all Israel with him went on from Libnah to Lachish and besieged it and attacked it. Horam, king of Gezer, marched up to help Lachish, but Joshua beat him and his people until no one was left alive. Joshua and all Israel went with him, went on from Lachish to Eglon. They besieged it and attacked it. The same day they took it and put it to the sword. That day he delivered over to the curse of destruction every living creature there. He delivered over to the curse of destruction every living creature there. Joshua waged war against all these kings for a long time, except for the Hivites living in Gibeon. Not one city made a treaty of peace with the Israelites, who took them all in battle. For it was the Lord himself who hardened their hearts to wage war against Israel, so that he might destroy them totally, exterminating them without mercy, as the Lord had commanded Moses. I put it to you that in modern day terms, Moses would be up in front of the International Criminal Court. Moses would be considered a war criminal in modern day terms. Those passages were from Joshua 10 and 11. This is from Numbers 31. And I've abridged this to bring out the key points. The Lord said to Moses, "Take vengeance on the Midianites for the Israelites." So Moses said to the people, "Arm some of your men to go to war against the Midianites and carry out the Lord's vengeance on them. Send into battle 1,000 men from each of the tribes of Israel." They fought against Midian as the Lord commanded Moses and killed every man. The Israelites captured the Midianite women and children and took all the Midianites' herds, flocks, and goods as plunder. They burned all the towns where the Midianites had settled as well as their camps and brought the captives, spoils, and plunder to Moses and Eleazar the priest. But Moses was angry with the officers of the army, the commanders of thousands and the commanders of hundreds, who returned from battle. "Have you allowed the women to live?" he asked them. "Now, kill all the boys and kill every woman who has slept with a man. But save for yourselves every girl who has never slept with a man." Now I go on to Christian fundamentalist, or I would prefer to say Christian literalist, because I think we all have to be fundamentalists. We all have to get down to the fundamentals. I go onto those websites that take the Bible literally to find out what they make of a passage like this. And they say, "Oh, well, you know, it would never really have happened. There's no evidence that Moses' Israelites went around raping everybody, because rape was a capital crime, so they couldn't have done it." Well, I think they need to look at Deuteronomy 21, because there you have an explicit law of Moses laid down, saying it's okay to take a woman as booty in battle, provided you give her 1 month in which to mourn, and then you have a ritual of marrying her. And if she doesn't please you, you release her, because you have defiled her. So if we're going to bang on about the law of Moses, and if we're going to hold other people to account on the basis of the law of Moses, let's be pretty careful how we do it. And let's not forget to read these kind of passages before we suggest such a thing. Now, does this mean that the Old Testament, or the Hebrew Testament, as our Jewish friends would prefer us to call it, is a write-off? I think not, because we have to ask what is going on here. We are looking at a religion that is clearly evolving through history. It's worth asking ourselves, does the Bible record just human history? Or is it also, in a sense, a representation of the evolution of the human understanding of God? Some people would go even further. Carl Jung has the audacity, I think wonderful audacity, to suggest that God in God's self learns what it means to be God through interaction with humanity, through interaction with the created world. After all, have you ever thought how lonely it might have been to be God were it not for the creation? Some theologians would say that is the essence of Trinitarian thinking, that in order to have love, the unity must become the multiplicity. In the East, they're very strong on that. They have all these gods, but all united through the one Brahman, the one Krishna. The Tao breaks fold into the many things, 100,000 things, but then reunites into the one. Same in our tradition. And when you look at the Bible, what you see coming out in the later prophets is a very different type of picture. In days to come, they shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. Isaiah and Micah. Or Hosea. Hosea 6, for I desire steadfast love and not sacrifice, the knowledge of God rather than burnt offerings. Isaiah 1, what to me is the multitude of your sacrifices, says the Lord? I have had enough of burnt offerings of rams and the fat of fed beasts. I do not delight in the blood of bulls or of lambs or of goats. Learn to do good. Seek justice. Rescue the oppressed, defend the orphan, plead for the widow. So it is imperative upon us not to become fixed in any literalist understanding. I would suggest not even to become fixed in any creedal or dogmatic understanding, but to be open to that movement of the Holy Spirit that takes us forward. And that's why I have always been deeply troubled by what in the culture I grew up in, remember I grew up in the Hebrides of Scotland in a Presbyterian context, I've always been troubled by blood atonement theories of what the cross is all about. I remember in school in the Nicholson Institute in Stornoway, we'd get taken along to the church every so often. And I remember hearing this sermon about blood atonement or something of that nature and feeling so outraged that I almost felt like standing up in front of the whole school and denouncing it. And probably quite a good thing I didn't, because I wouldn't have had my theological act together at that stage. But in preparation for this talk, I've been working on it now. And I've been reading things like J. Denny Weaver's book, The Nonviolent Atonement, trying to get my head around what is going on in atonement theories that are based upon the idea that somehow God had to be appeased for God's own wrath at human beings by the tortured suffering of he who would consider to be, who Christians would consider to be God's son. And by the way, remember John 10:34, Jesus' defense against blasphemy. where he cites the Psalms. We are all sons and daughters of God. Now, let's look at the atonement, because on the surface of it, you have at the heart of the Christian thing as it is presented to us, very profound violence, perhaps on behalf of God. And as many of you will know, I've just been discovering as I've been studying this recently, this is actually a very old debate going back to the earliest Christianity. The early church fathers, broadly speaking, believed that in answer to the question, for whom did Jesus die? Jesus died for us. But they believed it was in order to placate the devil. Now, it seems that within the Gospels, there is only one scripture text that really speaks specifically to that, and it's Mark 10:45, which reads, "For the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life a ransom for many." Or some scholars would say it should be translated, "a ransom for all." The Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life a ransom for many or all. And the question that vexed the church fathers and mothers is, who was Jesus having to pay this ransom to? Was it God or the devil? And the early view was that it was to the devil, that the devil had to be paid off in order to redeem the souls of humankind. This was known as the Christus Victor, Christ gaining victory over the devil. However, St. Anselm of Canterbury, who was the Archbishop of Canterbury shortly after the Norman invasion of Britain, an Italian who had become a Norman abbot during the 1066 invasion of Britain and then moved over at the time of William the Conqueror. Anselm of Canterbury put forward a formidable attack on that and said, quite justifiably, how come that God has to be paying a debt to the devil? That doesn't quite add up. And Anselm turned it around. Now, it's very important to realize that Anselm was coming from a culture that was deeply rooted in feudalism and in feudal conquest, feudal war, where the feudal lord of the manor demanded honor, demanded fealty, respect from the tenantry. And Anselm basically put forward a feudal model of God. He basically took the human social situation, one incidentally that was very much shaped by violence, perhaps not least the violence that he so often received apparently from his own father. And he projected this onto the divine cosmology. And he proposed that basically it is in order to redeem God's honor that Christ died for us. That God's wrath at the sin of Adam, imputed by original sins for all humankind, was so great that in order to save God's honor and allow God to love us again, Jesus had to give his life. That is the so-called satisfaction theory of the atonement. Very dominant, I'm led to understand, in the Catholic Church, where it was broadly speaking embraced. But even that wasn't quite good enough for some of the Protestant reformers, who came up with a more specific version of it called the penal atonement theory, which is a theory that I grew up in a Scottish context. And I'd like to read you from Calvin on this, to go to perhaps a source of its expression. This is translated from rather convoluted French, but we have to put up with that. Here we go. So this is Calvin from book 2 of his Institutes of the Christian Religion, chapter 16. The certainty here required is of no ordinary description. God cannot permit his law to be violated with impunity, but is armed for vengeance. Christ interposed, took the punishment upon himself, and bore by the just judgment of God what was impending over sinners. By this expiation satisfied and duly propitiated, God the Father, by this intercession appeased his anger, on this basis founded peace between God and men, and by this tie secured the divine benevolence towards them. Now Calvin does warn us, and I quote, that such modes of expression are accommodated to our capacity. He does suggest that this way of describing it, of God the angry Father, requiring his wrath to be appeased in this way, is a simplification for us better to understand how miserable and calamitous our condition is without Christ, as he puts it. Nevertheless, I would suggest to you that that caveat is normally left out of Calvin's teachings. And so we have this mainstream evangelical view, particularly strong in Britain and America, that the wrath of God is at the heart of the whole Christian thing. Now you can see, well, that's an oversimplification, because there was love behind that wrath that within a Trinitarian context meant that God nevertheless gave his son, etc., etc. Nevertheless, as Denny Weaver points out, violence is still at the heart of it. At the heart of it, you still have this punitive, violent model in penal substitution atonement theory. And my concern with that is that until we start to deal with that kind of violent element of God that we have seen is embodied in some of the early New Old Testament material, I do not think we will be able to reach forward to the true message of the cross about love. I do not think we will be able to tackle violence by developing a culture of non-violence in our times. And therefore, when somebody says to me, what can the churches do about violence? My answer is, start with your own theology. Look into your own hearts and start asking yourselves if theologies, systematic theologies that have been around, as we have seen, since the time of William the Conqueror, since those violent times, deeply violent times, let's remember the harrowing of the North when William Conqueror went up to finish off resistance in the north of England and committed genocide against 150,000 of the English by destroying their crops, burning their villages, putting everybody to the sword. Next time you hear somebody proudly tracing their nobility back to the Norman conquest, remember that. So I'm suggesting we need to start looking again at theologies put in place at that time. And where might we look to find such theologies? Excuse me, I've had a bit of a cold in the past week, so I'm having to look after my throat slightly. Well, I would suggest that from a Christian point of view, we need look no further than those later prophets who I've already mentioned, and to the Gospels. Love your enemies, do good to those who hate you, bless those who curse you, pray for those who mistreat you. If someone strikes you on one cheek, turn to him the other also. Mark 5 and Luke 6. Jesus himself seems to have been profoundly aware that he was wrestling with love in a violent world. Matthew 11. From the days of John the Baptist until now, the kingdom of heaven has suffered violence, and the violent take it by force. How often have we seen our churches taken by the violent, by force. Much of Anselm's, of Canterbury's work was made miserable because he had to spend his time negotiating between William the Conqueror's greedy nobles and the need for the church to have land from which beasts to serve the people. From the days of John the Baptist until now, Jesus said, the kingdom of heaven has suffered violence, and the violent take it by force. Oh, says the theologian, who wants to be able to justify redemptive violence, what Walter Wink calls the myth of redemptive violence in his incredible book, Engaging the Powers, that I highly commend to you. Oh, says such a theologian, so you're trying to make out that Jesus was a pacifist. Well, what about when he took the whip and drove the money changers out of the temple? That wasn't very pacifist. I get them saying that to me when I speak to the military. Well, go back and read John chapter 2 a bit more carefully. Let's see what it says there. When it was almost time for the Jewish Passover, Jesus went up to Jerusalem. In the temple courts, he found men selling cattle, sheep, and doves, and others sitting at tables exchanging money. So he made a whip out of cords and drove all from the temple area, both sheep and cattle. He scattered the coins of the money changers and overturned their tables. To those who sold doves, he said, "Get these out of here. How dare you turn my father's house into a market?" So he made a whip out of cords and drove all from the temple area, both sheep and cattle. It is the animals he drove out with the whip, because he was repudiating this earlier Old Testament idea that we need to pay for our sins with blood sacrifice. He was liberating the animals. It doesn't say he was driving people out. It says he drove out both. Both sheep and cattle, or whatever it was. So let's not use that one to make out that Jesus was into violence. But what about the time he told them to go and buy swords? A justification for armament. Well, let's look at that one in Luke 22. Then Jesus asked them, When I sent you without purse, bag, or sandals, did you lack anything? Nothing, they answered. He said to them, but now, if you have a purse, take it, and also a bag. And if you don't have a sword, sell your cloak and buy one. For it is written, and he was numbered with the transgressors. End quote. And I tell you, this must be fulfilled in me. Yes, what is written about me is reaching its fulfillment. The disciples said, "See, Lord, here are two swords." "That is enough," he replied. Now, if you read the biblical commentaries on that passage where he's quoting from Isaiah, I think it is, and he was numbered with the transgressors, the idea was that he was going to be perceived as one of the most evil, low people our society could imagine, such as would justify crucifixion. And so it is quite clear here that Jesus is taking up the sword is only symbolic in order symbolically to fulfill that prophecy. Hence why he says, that is enough. And then what happens when Peter gets a bit overzealous? He cuts off the high priest's servant's ear. Interestingly, the organ by which the servant would be able to hear. He cut off by violence the ability of the other to hear, which is what violence always does. Violence renders us senseless. Jesus replies in the various gospel renditions, "Put away your sword, Peter, for all they that take the sword shall perish with the sword. No more of this. No more of this." So I put it to you, friends, that challenging though it is, the gospel message is that we must try to learn to live non-violently. That we must try to learn to take away the causes of war. And instead of going around saying that Jesus taught just war, for which I see no evidence, start saying Jesus taught non-violence, even though I personally am not able at present, perhaps, to live up to it. What if you do try living up to it? What would it mean to live non-violently in today's world? One of the things that makes it so challenging is that it all goes so deep. I've already given the example of how in most of our consumer products, violence is embedded. The implication of that, however, is to understand even more deeply the importance of things like fair trade, the importance of seeking to trade in ways where we enter into right relationship, consciously so. Because the opposite of violence is relationship. The opposite of violence is empathy, is love. How do we invest our money if we have it? Do we need the money we've got, or can we let go of it? What kind of work do we do? If you could still cry, would you take the job? If you cannot cry, are you willing to go on a spiritual journey that might reopen the heart that has cauterized around you? Because that is what spiritual healing is about. What happens when you meet conflict in the street? Well, study peace, just as we have studied war in the past. Consider studying peace. Even the military staff college give half a day to it now in the session we have every year, looking at just war but also full-on non-violence and having a good debate about it. Let us study peace. I would recommend particularly Walter Wink's anthology of writings about peace. Study how to engage with people expressing violence. I always remember my first mistake I made in that respect. After I decided I was going to experiment with non-violence, encountering a man beating up a woman on the streets of Aberdeen one night. So determined to interpose my body between them, I did so, whereupon they both turned upon me and punched me on the nose and gave me a bloody nose. I learned to be careful about how one intercedes in such events. But I also remember another occasion of facing up to somebody who was threatening to be very violent in a situation which turned out to be much more dangerous. It turned out the guy had been quite psychotic in some respects and had been expressing violence towards others, so I didn't know that. And as I faced him and turned down his offers to fight him and said to him, "You can hit me if you wish, but I am not going to strike you back." I remember this, and it was outside Iona Abbey, of all places, on a starry night. And it felt like this hand coming down out of the sky and holding me in a confidence and a courage that I didn't otherwise know was there. And it just left me wondering, while we cannot depend on such a feeling being switched on, it does beg worth considering that if we try to commit ourselves to non-violence, we might be helped in ways we might never have thought of. For a number of years, I worked in an impoverished third world country. And violence is always a consequence of poverty, because violence is often the cause of poverty. Dom Helder Camara, the Brazilian archbishop, spoke of the spiral of violence. If you Google the word spiral of violence, the first link to come up will be his book by that title, which on realizing it was out of print, I scanned and put onto the web so you can download it. I commend it to you. He talks about level one violence, a primary violence of social injustice, structural violence, as Ronald Sider called it. And he said that leads to the secondary violence, level two violence, when the poor revolt, the poor take up revolutionary arms to seek justice. But that leads to level three or tertiary violence, when the powers that be repress the poor, further impoverishing the society, further creating the root cause of violence. And that our task today is to break that spiral of violence at its various points. And so I remember in Papua New Guinea, I'm sorry, I've named the country by accident, but there we are. These things happen in many poor countries. I remember one day in our small Quaker meeting being contacted by the parents of one of the teenagers in the meeting saying a terrible thing has happened. And their daughter had come home with her boyfriend at night to the gated compound in which they lived. And they'd stopped outside and found their car surrounded. The boyfriend was taken out and beaten up. The girl was led away and pack-raped by 14 young men. Now, I've worked quite a lot with such young men for the first 2 years of my time in Papua New Guinea. And it's heartbreaking the way that that happens, because you get decent young men wanting to do the right thing for their families and just wanting to be young men. And they go to the city, they don't get any jobs, they end up in the gangs, and part of the rite of passage can be things like rape, with the rape of a white woman in a black country being particularly highly prized. And so you get these very ugly dynamics setting up between expatriates and nationals as a consequence of that, that all feeds the spiral of violence. And the young girl, she was 17 at the time, said to her parents, "I don't want the police to do what they usually do, which is to go down to the squatter settlement and beat the place up, take it out of everybody. I want something to happen that will touch the hearts of those who did this." And so her father asked me if I would accompany him on her behalf. And in the cultural context, this was something that had to be done by men. And go down to the squatter settlement and talk to the people there. So we went down and we saw people sitting around. They saw us coming. They knew our business. They looked very shamefaced, and we asked if we could speak to their leaders. And so we had a meeting in the middle of the settlement. And we said to them, "The girl asked that the police shouldn't do what they normally do to you. And because nothing had happened, they realized the truth of that. And they said, 'We're really sorry what has happened.' They said, 'We, the parents, we can't control our young men either. We've lost all control.' And we said, 'She wants something to happen that might touch their hearts. What in your custom would be the right way to handle this situation?' And after considerable discussion, they said, 'In our custom, we must make payback. We must give compensation to you.' We said, we don't want anything from you. They said, 'But that is what we must do. We must give you food, chickens, vegetables.' 'Okay,' we said, 'well, if that's what you want to do, do that, and we can pass it on to the hospital.' On the appointed day, a great drumming noise came out of the squatter settlement, and a troop of 14 young men, with their entire village behind them, came down towards the university compound with wheelbarrows full of chickens and vegetables. And the father of the girl and myself Again, I say it had to be the men that culturally in that context did this. We stood there as one by one those 14 young men passed by and said in the Pidgin language, "Me pella sorry too. I'm truly sorry." And many of them had tears running down their faces. Not all. Some of them showed signs of bravado. But you could see that some of them had had their hearts touched. Some of them would perhaps live differently. I would suggest to you, friends, that that young girl's example is the kind of way in which we start to tackle the roots of violence. That is the kind of courage that we need. In 1943, at the heart of the Second World War, Patrick Kavanagh, the Irish poet, left us with these words. In his poem, Beyond the Headlines, if we want to read the signs of the times, we must go beyond the headlines. We must bring out the human. Seek that of God, even in the worst people we can imagine. Some of the earliest church fathers believed that there would even be redemption for demons and the devils. And the devil. Now, I would understand those things metaphorically or psychologically, but you may want to understand them literally. And I wonder if that's not an idea we need to go back to. That at the end of the day, there is universal salvation. That is the meaning of the cross. That is the meaning of the love of God. Abbé Pierre, the French friend of the poor, a priest, and I'll come to Kavanagh in just a moment. Abbé Pierre said of the theories of the atonement, "It has been while living for a long time amongst drug addicts that another explanation came to me. The addict is, in effect, at the same time, his own executioner and the victim. He is both the ransomer and the hostage. Based on this observation, I realized that it's the same with all human beings. Because we are disconnected from our authentic divine source, we have become our own executioners. We are slaves to our disordered desires, our egotism." He says that in Mon Dieu Pourquoi. In other words, the ransom of which Mark's gospel speaks is not a ransom to the devil, and neither is it a ransom to God. The ransom is to ourselves. It is us that have imprisoned ourselves. And that is the love of God, the love of Christ within a Christian framework that sets us free. Because it teaches us who we are, even if we have done the most despicable things. And so Patrick Kavanagh, Beyond the Headlines. "And then I saw the wild geese flying in fair formation home to Inishcore. And I knew then that these wings would outwear the wings of war. I knew then that these wings would outwear the wings of war. And a man's simple thoughts outlive the day's loud lying. So the wild geese flying knew then that these wings would outwear the wings of war, and a man's simple thoughts, a woman's simple thoughts, a child's simple thoughts outlive the day's loud lying. Don't fear, don't fear," I said to my soul. "The bedlam of time is an empty bucket rattled. Don't fear, I said to my soul. The bedlam of time is an empty bucket rattled. 'Tis you who will decide in the end who best battles. The bedlam of time is an empty bucket rattled. 'Tis you who will live. 'Tis you who'll decide who best battles. Don't fear, I said to my soul. 'Tis you who will decide who best battles. Only they who fly home to God. Only they who fly home to God. And then I saw the wild geese flying in fair formation home to Inishcore. Only they who fly home to God have flown at all. Have flown at all. Only they who fly home to God have flown at all. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Alistair. We haven't got very much time, but we have got time for just one question. If anybody has a question they want to ask, if anybody wants to ask a question, they need to come up to this microphone. No. Okay, well, we'll end there then. Thank you very much again, Alistair.
Just to say, on the question side of things, I had a very full presentation there, and remember that in the presentation I'm going to be doing on Monday at 5 o'clock, there'll be another one tomorrow on climate change. In Monday's one, I want to unpack some of these things in a much more discussive situation when we'll be inside a tent, and therefore we won't be in this rather impersonal context. So I'm intending to do a short presentation on Monday on the love of our times, on community, so we can have lots of time for discussion together. Thank you so much.